Hello, Rob Has a Planet, and welcome to a new podcast on reality TV wrap-ups. My name is Mike Bloom, and I am here to bring you a pitch for a new podcast about a little show called Shark Tank. But I'm not alone. I have a partner here with me on the pitch, but you have not heard of her before in the RHAP universe. She is not only an avid RHAP listener, but she also works in the entrepreneurial fields all the way out on the West Coast where entrepreneurs spring up like daffodils in Holland. So please give a warm RHAP welcome to Jasmeet Sidhu. Jasmeet, welcome to RHAP.
Hello, Rob Has a Planet. I'm so excited to be here. I've been a long time Rob Has a Podcast listener, and this is actually my first time on any of these podcasts, and I'm so excited to be here.
Of course, and we are so happy to have you. So as I just talked about, we are here to present to you a little bit of an intro podcast on the ABC reality show Shark Tank. Now, this is going to be an opportunity for us to kind of talk about the show in general, though we're kind of parlaying this into the episode that just came back, the one that aired on April 8th. It came back after a bit of a hiatus, so we'll kind of start off by talking about the show and then sort of segueing into our talk about this specific episode. But to start off, Jasmeet, since you're new to RHAP, I'm sure our listeners would love to know who you are, what your history might be, and how exactly you discovered the show Shark Tank.
Yeah, for sure. So since a lot of our listeners might be Survivor fans, probably a good chunk of them are, I probably could start off by saying that I first got introduced to Rob Had a Podcast probably back in Survivor One World. I started listening to it when I moved to a new city for graduate school and had no one to talk to about the show. So I think I Googled Survivor Podcast, found an episode, and have been listening ever since. In terms of the show itself, I've been watching Survivor since, you know, season one, episode one. And I was actually thinking about it. I was going to say I watched every single season, but when I was actually going through Wikipedia, I realized I'd never watched Guatemala. So that's the one season actually I've never seen.
Shame, shame. If this podcast gets picked up, that's your one goal between now and the next time we record.
I know. I got to watch Guatemala. But otherwise, personally, I'm originally from Canada. I was formerly working as a journalist, and then I started working at Facebook. And now I actually moved out here to San Francisco, where I'm working at a VC-funded startup. Have always been a huge fan of Shark Tank. I wouldn't say I've seen every episode, but I've seen the majority of episodes since season one. And the combination of those recent changes and me being a big fan, I thought it would be great to start a wrap-up on the show. So here I am.
Awesome. So I guess from my perspective here, I don't know how many people know this, but I actually graduated from my college with two degrees, one in economics and one in theater. And I almost feel like Shark Tank as a show kind of plays to both of those aspects almost.
I think you're right.
In that, I mean, the basis of Shark Tank, for those of you that might not know about the show, is that essentially every episode there is a panel of what they refer to as sharks, which are entrepreneurs and big business people from both this country and Canada, as it turns out. And basically every episode, about 3 to 4 to maybe even 5 different startups or, you know, fledgling businesses come and present their ideas. And essentially they want one of the sharks to come in on a bid to basically put up money for some sort of stake in their company. So there are a bunch of aspects. The presentation is one of them. The sharks putting up an offer, and then the negotiating part of it is a big aspect of it as well. But for me, one of the things that I love about the show is that it does sort of combine this whole negotiation aspect and all the big business stuff that you can find in an economics degree, but sort of with the creative wackiness that's found in a theater degree as well. I mean, this is a reality show, and I believe I read a statistic somewhere that like 0.2% of all businesses that apply for the show actually make it on. So they definitely choose the most bombastic and exciting, and that's sort of a blanket term to refer to either positive or negative businesses, they put there in front of the shark. So it's interesting because one of the things that I really enjoy about the show as well is that I feel like, unlike really any other show that's covered on the RHAP networks, this one is not very linear. That is, you're not going to tune in the next episode and find out, okay, what happened to this business the previous episode? Aside from the sharks, nobody really carries over, and it's meant to be really contained in one episode. So I haven't seen all the episodes either, but that being said, they rerun the hell out of it on networks like CNBC. So, I mean, I feel like Shark Tank to CNBC is like what Law and Order is to like any other basic cable network. So by like randomly having it on in the background sometimes, I've watched a good amount of episodes across the now, they're coming in at the close of their 7th season. So it's been 7 years of shows. Jasmine, I'd love to know from you, what do you love about the show in general? And does it tie into the work you do at all, or is it more oriented towards your reality TV love?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think you described it really well. It's really one of the very rare shows, the very rare reality shows, where I think it really matches that intersection of being extremely smart and entertaining. So your whole idea of like your economics background meeting your theater background, like you can think of an investment show and it could be done extremely poorly. I think Mark Burnett, which is the same team that did Survivor, he's the executive producer who brought this show back from international format. So we could talk a little bit about that. I think he found the right mix of really entertaining sharks. I don't think any simple investor could have fit this role really well. He's found like a good group of five or six that he rotates in. And the show remains really, really smart. I don't think they don't dumb down its audience or assume its audience is, you know, not up to date on certain things, even though occasionally they do the little banners at the bottom where they're explaining certain things. I think the show likes the idea that it maintains such an intelligent level of conversation and ideas. And I think that sweet spot that it's hit has made it really successful. And it draws me in every single week.
I completely agree with that. I mean, every episode they're talking about things like, you know, your profits and your target of margins and all that stuff. And for people outside of the business world, those terms might be confusing. But again, if you binge like four or five episodes in a row, eventually you're going to understand it. And it's also good to know that when the sharks make these deals as well, there are some contingencies in there. And in fact, in the episode we're about to talk about, there are contingencies that they throw in there as well, you know, contingent upon like certain big wholesale markets delivering on their end or contingent on a certain number of factors as well. You spoke towards the international aspect, and I feel like that segues perfectly into the origin story of Shark Tank, which started as a show called Dragon's Den, which first originated in Japan, but I know it was huge in Canada before making its way to the U.S. Now, Jasmeet, as one of our Canadian emissaries, I've officially given you that title right here. Did you watch Dragon's Den before when you were in Canada? Have you seen the show at all before?
Yeah, I mean, I caught it here and there. I didn't watch it as religiously as I do Shark Tank now, but I was definitely aware of it. So for those of you who just want to get quickly caught up on the history, the show Dragon's Den started out in Japan and then it was later actually brought to the UK. So the Canadian version was adapted from the UK version, which was adapted from the Japanese version.
This is like a game of reality TV telephone, right, where you're just whispering concepts to the next country.
I know. So what's actually important to know for Shark Tank is two of the Canadian investors on the Canadian version of Dragon's Den, Kevin O'Leary and Robert Herjavec, are actually two of the sharks on the current American version of the show. So those two have a history. Those two are Canadian. They were on the show in Canada, which aired on the CBC. And Mark Burnett, like I said, who was the guy who started Survivor, adapted the Canadian version of Dragon's Den and brought it to the US, I believe, in 2009, 7 years, 2009. And they originally started off with most of the current sharks were there from season one, the only original switch out. I think they replaced Kevin Harrington with Mark Cuban, I think, in season three.
Yeah.
Two or three, which I thought was a great move because Mark Cuban is obviously vastly more entertaining. And yeah, the show's been on for 7 seasons. Do you want to quickly go through who all the different regular sharks are and sort of their characteristics?
Since you're a Canadian, I feel like you would do justice to talk about our Canadian immigrants in Kevin O'Leary and Robert Herjavec to start off.
Well, Robert Herjavec is the son of an immigrant factory worker. I feel like I just want to...
I didn't know that. It's not like he doesn't repeat it every episode.
I kind of feel like I want to just repeat their like taglines that are constantly said at the beginning of the show. But we'll start with Robert. He is the son of an immigrant factory worker, I believe from Yugoslavia. Mm-hmm. So he might not be a great one to start with because I made a note. I'm like, oh, he started Herjavec Group, which is some sort of security solutions company. I don't exactly know what his company does, though. It's something like security, technology, whatever. You see the buildings all around Canada. He's obviously very successful. I kind of nicknamed him the last resort shark because I don't think anyone who ever walks into the Shark Tank actively aims to get Robert as their number one choice, but kind of end up with him if they don't get enough offers, which is kind of sad to say, but I think that's kind of the reality. And then kind of next to him, in terms of the Canadian counterpart, Kevin O'Leary, do you want to speak a little bit about him or should I?
Oh, Mr. Wonderful. So yeah, Kevin O'Leary is anchoring that center spot. I can't remember if he's always been in the center spot throughout, but as you said, he's been one of the mainstay sharks throughout. He is, you know, as the intro package that you alluded to, it talks about like, oh, the founder. Well, they started off by in the first season is about him being like one of the big software company founders. He founded this company called SoftKey, which was actually a big source of like probably a lot of computer games that you played when you were in elementary school most likely came from SoftKey. But he does a bunch of stuff now. I think he owns like a bunch of different, like he has his hands in a lot of different pots. But he is probably one of the bigger faces of the franchise, I would say, just because we can talk a little bit more about his personality later on, but he is a little irascible. He is very bombastic. In fact, I mean, I can definitely draw parallels to a certain American reality TV host, and he even did himself when he apparently, I found this out earlier this year in 2016, he said he might take a shot at Prime Minister of Canada after watching Donald Trump campaign. And like, until I saw that, I didn't put two and two together, and I can really see the parallels going on.
Right. I mean, for a more direct comparison, you know, American Idol just finished on Thursday. He is kind of like the Simon Cowell of the panel. You know, he's very tough with his opinion, maybe even a little too tough. He definitely plays up to the camera in terms of his one-liners. But he also plays the role a little bit of the narrator recapper. So even if he's not investing in a company, he kind of says like, okay, Lori's made this deal. Damon's made this deal. What are you going to do? So that's kind of his role as well on the show in terms of the center spot. And he's known as Mr. Wonderful, which is the ironic nickname, if anyone doesn't know that, because he's actually not that wonderful most of the time.
Yeah, and he also like looks like a Bond supervillain as well, because he's like bald and he has kind of a sharky looking suit. So he definitely plays up. He's one of those people that like knows the TV role he's playing, and he definitely plays that up well. Let's move to, you just mentioned Barbara Corcoran. She's not on the episode we're talking about. There are like six mainstay sharks right now, and they sort of cycle in which five will appear every episode, but Barbara Corcoran is a real estate mogul. Essentially, that's her big role here in New York City, where I am. I don't think I've seen anything that's, you know, has the Corcoran brand on it. I'm sure I have without even realizing it, but that seems to be her claim to fame.
Yeah, and Barbara, you know, she's got a really great story. If anyone doesn't know how she kind of came up in the real estate market in Manhattan, she started off as a waitress. They sometimes say that in her opening intro. And she built this company off of a $1,000 loan from her boyfriend, you know, made it into this multi-million dollar company. I believe she sold it actually in 2001. So when you see the Corcoran Group around New York, she's not actually directly involved anymore. But, you know, she's living off that cash and that name. So good for her.
Yeah, that quirky cash. I love it. Let's talk about Damon John, Mr. FUBU, though. He apparently, the, you know, nowadays, I think his intro package is really emphasizing that, oh, don't worry, Damon John's doing other things besides FUBU, because I feel like for a while that was all he was known to do. And I feel like FUBU, the brand, kind of died down from the mainstream in like 2005. But here he is. I mean, I would almost give him almost the nickname of Mr. Last Resort as well, just because first of all, I feel like Damon never takes deals. And when he does, I feel like everyone's like, okay, I guess I'll go with Damon. He's the only person that spoke up.
I mean, for sure. So, you know, FUBU, For You, By You was a hip hop clothing company, or For Us, By Us, I'm sorry, was a hip hop clothing company. I don't think it's actually actively producing clothing anymore. If you notice in his opening package, he has a company called Shark Tank Branding. So I think he's actually a shark that has benefited the most from actually being on the show and has kind of built new businesses off of this role that he has on the show. So that's interesting to think about.
No, I don't know. Robert Herjavec got a spot on Dancing with the Stars, so maybe he was the most famous out of all of them.
Right. I mean, Damon is definitely, he's pretty stingy on the deals, and he definitely ups the equity, as we're going to see as an example on the show. Like, he definitely doesn't give very easy deals for them to accept whenever he does offer a deal, which comes very rarely. So that's kind of his role.
So let's segue into, so those four that we just talked about started off the show. They've been in since the beginning, like a la Randy Jackson on the American Idol comparison. The only one, as you just mentioned, Jasmeet, was Kevin Harrington, who was sort of a QVC infomercial, the king of infomercials, I think they called him. But he dropped out after season two. And in season three, they gained a man by the name of Mark Cuban. So for those of you that don't know, he is the owner of the Dallas Mavericks.
The outspoken owner of the Dallas Mavericks.
Which is a family-friendly talk for, like, he causes a lot of fits and is, like, extremely angry and is not very highly regarded in the world of sports. Again, that's coming from me, so I might have no idea. But from what I've heard, he is is not very highly regarded in the basketball world.
I was going to say, I'm not really a basketball fan, so I will trust you on your opinion on that in terms of how he's seen in the basketball world.
Oh my God, that is in the kingdom of the blind, the one-eyed man is king. That's really the comparison here. So again, feel free to correct us if that's not true, but I just remember hearing some stories. He's also the chairman of Access TV, which is a network. He owns Magnolia Pictures. He also tried to pick up an app, I think a few years ago, called like Crop Duster or something like that, where he was like, this is going to revolutionize texting. This is going to replace things. So he's very, very into technology. And I would say outside of Kevin O'Leary, he might be the best TV on the panel, as you were talking about earlier, Jasmine, in that like he definitely knows how to play play up sound bites. He is very loquacious. He really likes to hear the sound of his own voice. He's very loud. So I feel like, and when Mark entered, he really overshadowed some of his fellow sharks.
For sure. And I was going to say, in terms of being good for TV, he is great with the eye rolls. He might actually, you know, be in competition with Eliza Orlins in terms of eye rolls on the panel. We're going to definitely see a lot more of those, hopefully, this season. Another thing to know about Mark Cuban, he and Kevin are the only billionaires with a B. I think the rest are just, you know, poor little millionaires.
Aw, poor them.
I know. But yeah, I know he definitely brought a lot to the show, and it was an excellent choice by Mark Burnett to, I think he was a get for the show, essentially.
And our second big get, she came on in season 4 after guesting in season 3, essentially replacing our old late night guy in Kevin Harrington, is Lori Grenier, the queen of QVC. So she is very much into like the household products, and we're actually going to see in this episode her take a bunch of her little baby businesses out to trade shows. Not only that, she's also widely known among Shark Tank fans as the warm-blooded shark, in that I would say she definitely seems like the most warm-hearted, probably the most personable, and definitely the nicest person on the panel.
I would challenge you on that. I think
I
think she plays tough. I mean, we're going to see her play a little tough in this episode, but from the episodes that I've seen of her, she comes off extremely warm, and I have no doubt that she is a warm and friendly person, but she plays tough with the deals, and she, like, you know, drops off other sharks when she doesn't want them involved with her deals. She challenges the contestants on the show. So she plays tough. I mean, I think she's one of those that comes off as warm, but like, don't let that fool you.
Yeah, I would say, yeah, she's probably not as motherly as I may have just depicted. I mean, I think, you know, when these people, I feel like when their backs, when the presenters' backs are up against the wall, they usually bring in like their sob stories about the life that they're living and how much they sacrifice in order to get this business started. And from that perspective, I do feel like Lori is the one who has her heartstrings tugged the most. But I do agree that like once it gets down to the nitty gritty and the deals are made, she is definitely the one to really, you know, become the shrewd businesswoman almost at a face turn and get down to business.
Awesome. So should we get into the products on tonight's episode or last night's episode?
Yeah, absolutely. So as I said before, essentially, they just almost sort of divided into segments. Sometimes there are commercial breaks in between to kind of build tension. I do want to talk about each episode starts, and it's almost like a Tonight on a Shark Tank kind of teaser in the beginning, where they introduce the show, but they're showing clips from the episode. And when I watch that, I don't know if you feel the same way, Jasmine, but I'm always a little confused because I almost think that they're going to show clips from like future episodes in the season. But it almost seems like they're saying this is what you're about to watch over the next 40 something minutes. And I don't know how I feel about that. I mean, I'm not in the camp of reality TV watchers that might drop out in the middle of the episode. I will watch an episode till the end, no matter how much I may dislike it. But I don't know. I have no reason to say, like, show me clips or don't show me clips. I'm still going to watch the show no matter what.
I think it works. You have to remember that the show airs on Friday night at 9 p.m. And I think they're going to do everything that they can to draw viewers in. And, you know, the opening packages don't bother me. What kind of bothers me is, it's kind of misleading. Like, you'll hear a voice bite or a sound bite where it's like, Kevin is like, you should drop this business and leave it forever. And then they'll zoom in on someone's teary face, but it won't be that business that they're overly critical of in the actual episode. Like, they'll mix and match like different scenes or different sound bites that aren't actually representative of what's going to happen in the show. So that's like my only little tidbit about that.
I'd agree with that. It's basically to make, you know, comparison to another show that happened to be about business. It's very like Mad Men-esque in that those teasers after the show would just show a bunch of randomly spliced lines. It's basically the reality show version of that. You know, it is, you know, compared to that's a next time on. And this is more so this is what you're about to watch over the next 40 minutes. So it's not as egregious as what Mad Men does, but it is definitely manipulative editing. And I mean, they do also give a disclaimer in the beginning, which always makes me a little uneasy about how they say, like, right. this stuff is real. Because again, I wasn't watching when it started, so I'm not sure if there were whodunit-esque cries from the audience about, like, this is all fake. There's also a disclaimer that says, like, that you are, like, the audience is not being asked to contribute to this business. So I wonder, was there a situation where, like, somebody called to ABC thinking, like, oh, I need to put $200 on the Squatty Potty. I want 1% in this business. And then ABC had to tell them, like, no, I'm sorry. That first of all, this was filmed like 6 months ago. Second of all, you have no way to contribute to this business whatsoever aside from buying their product.
Right. I mean, in terms of the legal disclaimer, I think that's just something they legally have to do in terms of like SEC, SSC. I don't know what the acronym is. In terms of like investing, they legally have to put that up front because it's not like they are requesting investments from the audience. If they were, they would have to make that very clear. And we should probably say on our podcast that we are not giving anyone investment advice, and this is all just for entertainment. So please do not send us emails and tweets saying that we convinced you to make an investment that went horribly wrong. We just thought
please send us money. We will gladly take the money.
Awesome. Do you want to get started?
Let's start with our first pitch here. Pride Bites Pet Products, a pitch given by Sean Necht and Steven Bluestein, and also a dog named Sadie happens to be there as well. So this is essentially customized designed products for your dog. As Mark puts it, it's essentially like Shutterfly for pet products, where essentially what you get to do is you get to go, you would think an online store, though they're building that out, and essentially you pick the product, you pick the design for the product, you pick basically the picture you want on the product and the name, and they will customize it completely for you. Now, before we get down to what the sharks think about it, I figure for each of these pitches, let's get our thoughts about it in general. Let's put ourselves in those very comfortable chairs in the Shark Tank and kind of give our thoughts on it. So, Jasmine, looking at this purely from the pitch alone, are you in on Pride Bites?
I'm not, and I guess I would have to bring my own personal biases in this. I'm not really a pet person. I mean, I understand people love their pets. There is definitely a market of like people who would get these things done for their pets, and these are great gift items, especially at Christmas. I could imagine like their sales would spike if this show had aired maybe in October, November. Like, oh God, I need something to buy for Christmas. But it's, you know, it's Mark said it, you know, later on in the segment, this is something that's so replicable. It's, you know, there's no entry to market. Anyone can make a customize this little kitschy gift online. It's nothing unique to what they're doing. They don't have any sort of leg up on this market. So that would be sort of my red flag that this is not something I want to get involved with.
I think Shark Tank has taken a really interesting turn just by comparing like the history of not only startups, but almost the internet age compared to this show as well. Because first of all, the show, as you said, started in 2009, which was when we were still in the economic recession. And when you watch those first few episodes in the first season, they actually bring it up as well of like, I know it's a tough economic climate, but we really need your money. And I feel like you could take some of this stuff here. And actually, when my wife was watching this show with me last night, I pitched the idea to her and she said, oh, I feel like that's an Etsy thing. And I feel like that's the problem with some of these like customizable, personalized products that these people are trying to shill out, is that I feel like that stuff is doable on Etsy. And I am a pet owner, so I'm probably more likely to buy into this than you are. But that being said, we also don't have too many personalized products for our pet. I mean, I don't know too much about pet psychology, but I doubt that them owning a bowl that has their name on it will make them any happier than them just owning a regular bowl to begin with. So it'll get more enjoyment from the owner itself. And I mean, you're able to like, I think the most customizing you're able to do is like get, you know, make a dog tag at Petco. And that being said, maybe it's because I live in a world without customized pet products, but I'm totally fine without it. So I would probably be more in than you were. But I would probably eventually be out as well, because I do agree with what you brought up with Mark's point that, I mean, it's a big barrier to entry here, in that it's not like you're tackling a niche market, because there are individualized merchants online and in person that can do this for you. And I think the online factor is a big, big sticking point for me as well. I mean, they talk about how they've been basically marketing this stuff to, you know, to retail, to pet stores, and just basically through word of mouth. But they don't have an online presence. And I feel like they plan to, and they have all these ideas about like, oh, our turnaround time's originally 4 weeks, but I want to bring it down to 2 weeks. And I don't know. I appreciate what they're doing on the smaller scale, but I feel like that's not manageable. If you're trying to expand to like a global market, you can't realistically say we're going to expand our markets 100-fold, but we're also going to bring down our turnaround time as well. I feel like those goals are almost working against each other.
Right. Can I just bring in a little side note? Did you notice how they made a product that was based off of Robert's dog? And I was just wondering, like, how did they know what Robert's dog looks like? Unless they like creeped on his Instagram or something.
Oh, that was the worst. Yeah, that was the weirdest part. Yeah, they're like, oh yeah, we saw pictures of your dog, and I'm like, oh, that's a little creepy. This will not be the creepiest part of the moment of the episode. That will be coming up, and I will be sure to point that out in my opinion. But yeah, being like, obviously you want to appeal to each person. I know you said Robert is Mr. Last Resort in your opinion, but maybe because he's a dog owner, they thought about appealing to him specifically.
I mean, Robert was all over this. He was like loving that dog and he was genuinely interested in it. I mean, speaking of it, we should probably talk about the different offers. So we didn't mention that the original ask was for $200,000 for 10%, making it a valuation of $2 million. They said that they sell their products in the ranges of $999 to $150. Like you said, turnaround time in 4 weeks. And they said they've been going for, I think, 2.5 years, and their overall sales have been $1.4 million. Not bad.
Not bad.
So Robert, you know, did mention the 4 week wait time being a problem for him. And he immediately cuts the valuation in half, though. He's a pet guy. He's interested in this, but he's cutting it in half. And he makes an offer for $200,000 for 20%. What did you think about that?
Yeah. So this Shark Tank aspect is always interesting to me as well, because I am also not a good negotiator whatsoever. So I always sweat on behalf of these people that they have to negotiate like this. I mean, these guys always shoot high when they come in. I feel like these people always represent their businesses at like $1 million net worth, $2 million net worth. And I mean, I'm sure the producers kind of coach them to aim high and then settle for low, but I would definitely agree with that. I mean, I would probably be even shrewder and cut it down further, because again, these people are not, they're not really expanding right now, and they also have not made an online presence. So it's a really big gamble to say they're going to be worth $1 million down the line, let alone $2 million, in my opinion.
Right. So we should probably mention this is around the point that Damon John, you know, very rarely makes a deal. He jumps out. And then Sean and Steven then go back to Robert and they ask him to go down to 15%. So at that same point, Lori cuts in and she's like, well, I haven't made you my offer. And then, you know, this is where they go into their commercial break to create some tension. What are they going to do? So she cuts in looking like she wants to make an offer. And I believe she comes back with $200,000 at 18%. And then this is where I kind of get, you know, a little eye rolly, because for me, these small percentages don't mean a huge deal, but they're always arguing about it. And she gives them this offer and you can tell that they don't like it. And she's just kind of smiling at them and they're going back and forth. They counter back $300,000 for 20% for both Lori and Robert. And then Robert comes in, he's like $300,000 for 30%. And that's where I'm like, this is getting a bit unreasonable.
Yeah. And I think there is a certain part of these sharks that are like, we are making good TV here. Because I do agree, it's very negligible that Lori comes in for what, like 2% less than what Robert did. She's not really undercutting him that much. That's also an aspect that we really haven't talked about yet on this show, which I think one of the winning factors it does have is the interaction between the sharks itself. Much like The Voice, I think a lot of people find the appeal of The Voice is how the coaches interact. And for example, like the budding bromance between Blake Shelton and Adam Levine. I feel like where people kind of get
that's
their
not
pleasure
a budding bromance. That is a full out bromance at this point.
Don't let Gwen know that.
But
I think that one of the things that I really like about the show are the way these people kind of play and poke with each other as well, because they're also business people. And when two people are interested in an idea, which we see here with Lori and Robert, they're going to start, you know, taking jabs at each other until Robert eventually says, like, you know what, why don't we just work together and go in on this together? Which is also an aspect that sharks can do sometimes, is that they'll cooperate and they'll broker a deal together.
Right. So, you know, he makes the $300,000 for two sharks for 30%. Then he comes back to $200,000 for 20%, which was actually the original offer that he made. But now it's with Lori in it. And now Lori is doing the stall technique. And there's this tension of like, Robert's ready to make the deal, but Lori's like, wait a minute, let me look at my notes. So we got a little bit of stress going on for the contestants here.
Yeah, well, this is, again, like another one of these faulty commercial breaks, because as soon as it happens, then Kevin O'Leary steps in and is like, okay, I'll do it if Lori won't. And then Lori's like, nope, I'm in. So it was like very, very anticlimactic. So yeah, right. It seems like Pride by Its Pet product succeeds. We should also point out that essentially at the end of each of these segments, the business can essentially take the deal that's been given to them if they're given an offer, or they can deny the deal and just walk away, or if they don't get anything, they'll be out completely, which will be an option that's brought up with one of our businesses later on in the episodes. There are essentially three outcomes. And basically, I mean, would you say that Pride Bites walked away with a pretty good deal? I mean, they got the same amount of money just for just with twice as much, but they have two investors now.
Right. So they finally settled on $200,000 for 20% with Lori and Robert. And you know what? I think that's pretty good. You've got Lori on the consumer product side, you know, definitely with her connections. You know, whenever she sees a product like that, she, you know, thinks she can get all over this. And then Robert, who is a pet lover, you can tell he's passionate about it. I think whenever... I kind of feel bad now for calling Robert the last resort shark, but when he does get involved with things, I do think he's doing it from a genuine spot of interest in terms of what he likes and the subject areas he's interested in it. Yeah, I mean, I definitely do think they came in knowing that they weren't going to get the 10% equity. So I think they were ready to accept, you know, giving away 20%. And I think this is one of those things where the sales are going to spike after the airing of the show. So even if they make a lot of money this year and then the company fizzles out, I mean, that's still good for them, I think. I don't think the long-term viability is there, though.
So speaking of that, this is not a show where you're sort of one and done. You disappear forever into the world of business. What Shark Tank has done in the past few seasons is that they've incorporated this sort of little update, where are they now segment. Occasionally, usually focuses on only one business to just give, and they sort of, you know, bring the cameras to the place where they're located and to film how good they're doing. But here's a little bit of a rarity in that Lori is at a hardware trade show in Orlando, and she has brought 10 of her entrepreneurs to show off products there.
Yep. So this is the Shark updates that they do every now and then in the episodes. And this is kind of like Lori's Hall of Fame happening here. You've got past products that have been super successful. Scrub Daddy, Drop Stop, Screen Man, Instafire, Squatty Potty, which wasn't Richard Hatch invested in that at some point?
Yep.
Yeah. Fiber Fix.
So he's definitely one of the buyers. I would say the two that I knew of watching these 10 were Squatty Potty and Scrub Daddy. I believe they've said like Scrub Daddy might be the most successful product to ever come out of Shark Tank.
I think that's true, yeah.
So Scrub Daddy, for you, if you don't know, is a sponge which basically changes consistencies based on the water you use. So I think if you use warm water, it gets like softer. If you use cold water, it gets harder to scour more. But it has like skyrocketed. It basically became like the Kelly Clarkson of Shark Tank products.
Right. And yeah, I mean, it brought Lori a lot of success and like really gave her this niche space, as she's going to mention later on, of being really dominant in the hardware space among the sharks, which is really interesting considering where she started off from, which was making like, you know, jewelry boxes. So good for her.
Yeah. And I'm sure, you know, they had to bring in, I'm sure it was in their contract that these entrepreneurs had to give in and give their requisite talking heads about like, Lori's the best. I feel like the most popular kid in school. Cool. This is fantastic. I mean, good for her. She apparently, like, cumulatively, their 8 million sales from before Shark Tank have skyrocketed to 188 million. Though, because Scrub Daddy is so popular, I wonder how much of that share is Scrub Daddy.
Right. I would think a good chunk of that is Scrub Daddy, but I'm sure the others are doing pretty well as well.
Yeah. So let's move into our second pitch of the night. Trobo, the storytelling robot, presented by Chris Harden and Jeremy Scheinberg. It's essentially a Teddy Ruxpin for the new batch of children with app and iPad tablet integration. Overall, what are your thoughts on Trobo, the storytelling robot?
I kind of thought it was creepy. I don't know. Maybe.
Yep.
I mean, I don't know. I can't imagine buying something. I mean, no, I could imagine buying something for this for my kid, but I just didn't see like what was so unique about it. Like they mentioned it in the later in the segment, the teddy bear is pretty much the sound box. So it is actually relying on the content that they're producing on the iPad, I believe, which anybody can do. There's nothing unique about this. And it's just another one of those things where I'm like, for $60, I'm passing.
Yeah. So essentially what this is It's a stuffed animal, which literally, I mean, Lori pulled it out. It just has like a little Bluetooth speaker in it. So as you said, this the teddy bear is merely just like a conduit for sound to come out. The basic concept lies in this tablet where, you know, they'll write a personalized story about this and you get to like drag and drop. You get to interact with the tablet to make the story work. But I agree, that voice is by far the most creepy part of, because like, imagine, okay, you're putting your child to sleep and you're like, okay, let's have, you know, Jack and Jill starring Raymond. And then you hear this voice like, Raymond, you are going up the beanstalk.
Right. I just had this vision of like this dystopian future where like the parents are no longer involved in children's lives and they're just left with these teddy bears that are parenting them. Like, that's what I was thinking throughout this.
Trobo rules the house now. Yeah, it's really like, if I was a child, I would be extremely unsettled if that voice came out. I mean, I think there is technology nowadays that kind of deals with that. Leapfrog is the one thing I can think of where it's like that little interactive storybook that if you press the pen to the word, a voice will say the word. So I think the technology is out there, but I don't think we need another Teddy Ruxpin, especially since, you know, they pointed out, these guys counter with the Teddy Ruxpin argument of like, the sharks argue you're charging too much. And they say like, well, Teddy Ruxpin went for like $70 in the 80s. But I think it's Damon that points out like, technology has gotten so much better and kids have become so concentrated on virtual things. You know, I can't count how many kids I've seen on the subway that are playing on iPads, that I feel like if you're going to try to bring it back to that aspect, I feel like you're undoing things almost.
Right. So to recap a little bit, their ask was $100,000 for a 10% stake in their company. They are retailing this for $59.99. And I believe they've only made 600 orders on this. Yep. So going through the sharks, Mark, you know, he makes the same observation I made. It's all about the content and he just doesn't see a lot of play over there. So he's out. Kevin, this is kind of his world. He comes from the children's educational world. And he's saying that, you know, unless you got Target and Walmart on board, this is not going to go anywhere. And he said that they're not going to get on board because this is way too expensive for them. So he's out. Lori, she's going by the low orders number. She doesn't see that as a good sign. She's out. And then this is where the personal appeal comes in. How do you feel about the, you know, the life story, personal pitches that come in on Shark Tank every now and then?
So I'll definitely say that I think that's probably one portion of the application process, I'm assuming. I know I've been making a lot of American Idol comparisons throughout this podcast, but I feel like the process for selecting these businesses are very akin to like the American Idol auditions of yore, Will, where they'll pick some bad ones, they'll pick some good ones, but they're going to pick ones that tell a story. And occasionally what they'll do is they'll have these pre-recorded segments that they'll put on actually before the pitch where you like, they film these guys quote unquote in their natural environment, which we'll see in the next segment, to kind of introduce the product more, where it'll be a little bit of a surprise, or they won't necessarily say what the product is, but we'll get to know them a little bit. So, I mean, everyone sort of has a story here. In this case, Chris talks about how, you know, his father died when he was six, his mother went to prison, and he was always raised on this concept of like, education is king. You could do anything as long as you have an education. And I mean, considering that Robert is the only one left, I mean, Lori bows out because they say that they went to two toy expos and really didn't get a bite. And Lori, that's very unsettling for her. So they say, okay, son of an immigrant who also had to pull himself up by his bootstraps, let me appeal to you. And it's debatable to say whether or not it works because Robert's the only one to really bite at this one.
Right. And if anyone wants to make an emotional appeal about, you know, working hard because of your parents, Robert's the one to go to.
Yep.
I mean, he says there's no real wow factor, but on Robert's end, he has his DreamWorks connection. So he makes a suggestion or the offer of $100,000 for 30%, which, you know, completely divides their valuation by three. But it's contingent on a licensing deal with DreamWorks. So I guess in his mind, he's thinking the stuffed animals could be, you know, Shrek, and the stories could be, you know, Shrek related stories. And I was not a fan of the product, but considering where they are now, they only have Robert to go on. I really do think they're desperate at this point. So I'm thinking they should take this.
And they don't.
And this
is another interesting aspect as well. And maybe, again, a reason why they're brought on is because of their personality and their bullheadishness. Because they say, yeah, no, we're not going to take that. So they do $166K for a 33.3% stake, I believe it is. Or I believe that's the one that Robert makes. But they eventually negotiate down to that. The more Shreks idea was also very creepy, in my opinion. Now I'm imagining in this world that you imagine when there are no more parents. Now I'm imagining these like Terminator-like Shrek androids that are walking around the planet terrorizing children.
Yeah, very scary, but whatever. They're making a deal, so you know, they come back with 166,000.
Exactly.
And the show actually notes in the little card at the bottom that this is now a $500,000 reduction in the original valuation that they came in. So their valuation is going all over the place at this point. I think they're desperate. Yeah. And they really, they're one of the people who come into a Shark Tank that are so desperate to make a deal. And lo and behold, Robert says yes. And Damon John is like, what? Did you notice that?
The other sharks are not happy about that. In fact, when they walk out, since the Trobo robots are still left there, Kevin takes one of the robots and like mimes a voice that the robot tells Robert that he just screwed himself. Because I kind of have to agree here. You know, if they were out on Pride Bites because they felt like they couldn't really get into the market, I feel like it's even worse with Trobo. So again, maybe it was appealing to Robert's emotional aspect, and maybe it's just because he has that deal inked with DreamWorks. It'd be interesting to see whether or not that deal went through, and as a result, whether Trobo was funded. But I don't know. I feel like I don't think these pitches were in order, but maybe if they did, Robert was feeling just very giddy from buying Pride Bites, and he was still thinking about his dog that he decided to take Trobo under his wing.
On that production note, I'm someone who's definitely worked in production in my previous life. These pitches were definitely not filmed in order. Just so you know, an FYI, like they do like a couple filming days in LA every now and then, and they instruct them to wear the same clothes. So some of these pitches could have been over several months apart. They could have happened. One could have happened in the morning. One could have been the last one of the day. So these were definitely not filmed chronologically. But, you know, to the viewing audience who, like, they don't care, I don't think. But it's interesting to note, like, the different temperaments. Like, they would mention a comment on a previous deal that they would never do on a second deal, but then they end up doing that on a third deal. So that's something interesting to observe on a meta level with the sharks. But going back to this deal, I would definitely give it a thumbs down. I mean, like I said, these guys are desperate, so it was good for them. They got a lifeline into DreamWorks, potentially. I don't think the DreamWorks thing is going to happen, so it's kind of good for Robert as well, because if he doesn't get that through, then he doesn't have to make the deal. I don't think anything's going to happen out of it, so I give it a thumbs down.
I would also say I think the Shrek well dried up like 5 years ago, in my opinion. I think the fourth movie came out in like 2011, but Shrek is not nearly as popular as it was at the beginning of this millennium.
For sure. Should we go to pitch three?
All right, let's go to pitch three. And pitch three, this is actually something that like made news. Before the episode aired, my wife actually sent me this article from ABC News about the No Phone. And it had made, you know, news about like, this is a completely ridiculous product on paper, and it has somehow made its way onto Shark Tank, which, thinking about the way reality TV works, I think you can completely understand why No Phone made its way onto Shark Tank. But we start off with this little pre-package intro about these two guys living in New York, and they notice everyone's on their phones all day. They need to start communicating. And I think they have this extremely hokey scene where they're like sitting in some sort of office, and one of the guys just writes down something on a piece of paper. And he goes,
I wrote that down. This is the cheesiest reality scene I've seen in a while. That like scene where they're just like writing something on a notepad.
Yeah, not since The Hills have I seen such like blatantly staged reality TV. So these are guys are Van Gould and Chris Sheldon, but they definitely make an impression when they walk in. They walk in on their phones. They begin their pitch on their phones. The editors do a fun thing where they actually show Mark being on his phone before the pitch happens. But they basically present this idea of the No Phone, which is essentially what I think is like a nicotine patch for phone addiction, where it's a piece of plastic that is not electric, has no essential function aside for you to just serve as something you can hold in your hand instead of a phone.
Right. And they give an interesting statistic. 70% of adults have their cell phone with them 22 hours a day. So Mike, how often do you have your cell phone on you? Does it hit the 22 hour mark?
I mean, I guess so. Thinking about it, I mean, I sleep with it like charged next to me, but I don't look at it in the middle of the night. So I'm not sure what like with them is defined as, whether it means like within a certain amount of feet from you. I guess I'm part of that 70%. I guess I'm part of the problem. I'm not entirely sure. What about you, Jesmeet?
So I guess that I would think that they're making that judgment based off of, is your phone within an arm's length distance of you at all times? So you're not actively using it, but like, is it beside your nightside table? Is it on your office desk when you're working? Is it in your pocket when you're traveling? And I think I definitely hit that. I'm like, my phone is kind of always near me. I use it for an alarm clock. I use it, you know, to send emails, obviously to make phone calls, and I wouldn't say I'm addicted to it, but I know a lot of people that are just randomly, subconsciously checking it like every 3, 4, 5 minutes.
But I would say, I mean, you also work in the world of startups, though, and I feel like with startups, it's the community, you have to be very dependent on communication. So I feel like it also has to be like part of your job personally too, though, right? Is to keep your phone with you at all times?
For sure. But I don't think it's necessarily limited to startups. I mean, I used to work as a journalist as well. So maybe I've only worked in these unique industries where people are obsessed with their phones. But I've been surrounded by people the last 5 to 10 years. And when did the iPhone come out? 2004, like 10 years. Yeah. Who have just always had their phones with them. And I think a real reason why you've heard of this product before Shark Tank was because it really hit a cultural touchstone on how addicted people are to their phones.
Yeah. I mean, I would say I think Damon might have brought this up. I don't know if it was him or another shark when they're talking about it, that like this seems like almost a joke product, like a novelty product, something you might find in Spencer Gifts. And I could totally imagine there being like, you know, a Funny or Die or an Onion video on like the new iPhone came out and it's just a brick that you need to carry around. So you obviously need something in your hands at all times. I do like the pitch. I think the pitch is very tongue in cheek, and it definitely is one of the funnier pitches that I've seen where they say like, step one, pick it up. Step two,
the
hold
pitch
it.
Was very
and,
funny.
Then and then there's like a subtitle that says like not intended to be used for anything. And then there's the selfie model, which is just a mirror. So I think they succeed on the pitch. I just think it's the concept that makes the sharks immediately buy out on it.
Well, speaking of the concept, let's talk about the sales. So they sell this thing for $12, but you can get the selfie upgrade, which is essentially just taping or installing a mirror on the phone for $18. And they've sold over 3,000 units of this, in resulting in $42,000 in sales. Can you believe that?
Yeah, I mean, I can. Again, if they're unlike Pride Bites, utilizing this online spectrum, I feel like there are a lot of people around the country that could be like, oh, this is a funny gag gift. Let me buy it. But that being said, if they are releasing it countrywide, $3,100 actually might be a little low. But again, it is over the past, 4 or 5 months? And I mean, they're not asking for too much. They're not valuing their company at $1 million. They're seeking $25,000 for a 15% stake. So I feel like, you know, I think they were very reasonable in that, like, I know these sharks are going to be very hesitant to buy in to begin with. So let's not overwhelm them with a really big offer.
Right. I mean, I think everyone kind of knew what was up. Like, I mean, do you honestly believe they think this is a viable company that can last for more than a year? Because I kind of feel like they know the deal. They know what's up. And they're just going to try to rack up their sales and ride this high for as long as they can. But they kind of know that this is not some sort of long-term viability thing.
Yeah, but I mean, this is a big dressing down from the sharks. And they just, nobody really like plays with this concept. They just go down the line. I mean, first, you know, Mark Cuban always seems to be the patent guy. He always seems to ask if they have a patent on this product. And they say they do. But then he like sort of twists it back at them and calling it a dumb patent. And he's out of that. Then Lori says like she makes this weird analog about like, hey, remember the kitten hanging from the branch, the hang in there motivational poster? Well, maybe that cat should drop. So she's out. Robert says, you know, you sold 3,100.
He thinks it's clever, though. He thinks it's clever.
He thinks it's clever, but he thinks that like they might have reached their limit with the 3,100 that like nobody else might want to actually buy it. So he's out. Then Damon just flat out says, I think it's stupid. Which is again,
I think his exact quote was, I would feel stupid investing in this. So you know where Damon's heart is lying.
Absolutely. And then it comes down to Mr. Wonderful. And I mean, Mr. Wonderful is enough of a wild card that he might just randomly buy into this. But he says, you know, this is a nothing product. And so he's out as well. So these guys get the rare edit of going home empty handed, though they are very confident that the no phone is going to be the pet rock of our generation.
Right. And I was going to say they definitely left Kevin last for this product because they wanted that line. This is poo poo. And that's how that segment ends. And I think their last words before the commercial break happens is, this is going to be a revolution. So is this going to be a revolution, Mike? And we just don't know it.
By a revolution, it means that they just turned around in a circle. I guess that's the only revolution that they're capable of. I feel like we do live in a world sometimes where I think a lot of our humor is ironic. So there might be a market with some people. I mean, 3,100 people have already bought this product for its sort of ironic qualities. But I sort of agree with Robert here that I don't think a lot of people are going to be like, ooh, let me actively seek it out. You know, you can't put this in like a Bed Bath & Beyond with an As Seen on TV sticker and people will actually invest in it. But I do like, as you talked about with the going down the line with the sharks, it's sort of bookended with arguably the two biggest mouthpieces in Mark and Robert, with Mark saying it's a dumb patent and then finish it off with Kevin O'Leary calling it a poo-poo idea. So good on the editing for the Shark Tank producers. Let's move into our final pitch of the night for Cool Box. And this brings up an interesting question, Jasmine, that I want to get your opinion on. I mean, obviously, these businesses come in with their own names, and your mileage may vary on how good these names will be. What do you think about the names overall, and where does Cool Box fall in your big list of Shark Tank business names?
I mean, I think if you can't figure out what the product is by the name, you've got a problem. So when I hear Cool Box, I think of a cooler. Like, you know, those things where you want to keep your drinks cold. And that's not what this is. This is a smart toolbox. So in terms of rankings, I mean, just from a very simple business standpoint, if you can't figure out what the product is, or at least get close to it by the name, you might want to rethink the name.
Yeah, I mean, you can make fun of I want to draw a cat for you all you want. But that being said, it did have the function in the title, and it did actually get a bid, unlike something like NoPhone. I agree. I thought Cool Box, and especially looking at the box, I thought it was supposed to be like some sort of half cooler, half toolbox. But no, these guys, Chris Stoikos, who looks like he's been living out in the woods for the past couple years, and Jason Neubauer are presenting this, as you said, a smart toolbox, which is essentially a toolbox with a bunch of electronic accoutrements attached to it. It has a power strip, has a whiteboard, a flashlight, iPad, and iPhone stand. So, you know, once you're done with Trobo and you need to charge your kid's iPad, you can do it there.
Like, you can charge your kid's teddy bear in the toolbox.
Yeah, exactly. You could plug Trobo in right there as he charges to slowly, you know, kill the parents and take over the world. There's USB ports, there's a bottle opener, there's wireless Bluetooth speakers. They come in $500K for 10%, valuing their company at $5 million. Yep. And there are a lot of contingencies going on with this product, I feel, Jasmine.
Yeah, for sure. So they come in with the biggest ask of the night, which is usually how Shark Tank kind of structures it, like what's going to have the biggest stakes. And yeah, so they're selling, or they make the Cool Box for $110, and they've pre-sold for $190, and they're retailing for $249. They said they got $370,000 in pre-sales. And, you know, the cost is a big point for these guys. You know, Robert comes in right away saying the costs are really high, the margins are low, and they don't have retail or distribution happening at this point. My biggest reaction when I saw this, when you think of a toolbox, right, you think of I wouldn't say a simple guy, but you think of a guy in his garage. He's working with his hands. He's making something. It's very anti-technology in a sense. So I feel like there's a disconnect to the product that they have and who the customer is going to be. Because when I think of who's buying toolboxes, it's more of the person who wants to do something with their hands. They're out in the real world. They're not like on their apps. They're not, you know, making up different electronic things. So I feel like there's a disconnect between who, like what this product is and who the potential customer is going to be.
I agree. I feel like this is a product like purely for carpenters, not even like architectural people, just purely carpenters, because I feel like the guy that's like working on a little project out in his garage is not going to use a whiteboard, you know, he doesn't need to necessarily like plug in his phone using a USB port. I mean, I don't know who Chris and Jason are and where they come from, but I feel like if I'm basing something off of Chris's appearance, he might work in like the field of carpentry, and so he might feel that this is a necessity in that field. But that being said, I mean, looking at it purely from a point of view where neither of one of us work that much in that realm,
right?
I just don't know how much of a use it has, especially since I think one of the other big sticking points of this product as well, among the many, is that they have a patent, but they have it purely on like this iteration. And I think Mark is the one to point out, like, hey, Black & Decker could take this product, take out the USB ports, and say, hey, this is a completely different product using that sort of logic, and then completely undercut your pricing. So I feel like they really leave themselves open to kind of get copycatted.
Right. I mean, so they mentioned they have a provisional patent, I believe, in the works, but that patent's only for the toolbox having every single one of those things, the USB port, the iPad stand, the whiteboard. So yeah, I mean, anyone can take and separate any of those elements and add it to the toolbox, and then, you know, they got a knockoff. And another thing that really bothers me is, like, can you really see this in a Home Depot? I feel like you're either going to get this in Best Buy, which is not going to really belong in because it's kind of an electronic product, but not really. And it's not going to really fit on a shelf at Home Depot. So again, I go back to like, who are they building this for? Like, what is the market? And I just don't see it there.
Yeah. And speaking of that, so they say they have a deal with Lowe's. It's an ink deal for like an 8,000 unit order. But can you describe to me, I got a little bit confused about this whole like inventory talk. So they're making it overseas, but their current inventory is like held up and they need money in order to make that 8,000 unit deal with Lowe's. Is that correct?
This is where I kind of got lost in the conversation as well. It was just going back and forth too fast. So from what my understanding is, they have an 8,000 unit, not order, but a promise to buy from Lowe's. They said they haven't had the order because Lowe's doesn't make the order more than 2 months out. So they say they're 30 days from that. And this is kind of where I get lost in the conversation, where they need to be able to deliver 2,200 units. So they're raising a total round of 1 million and kind of got a little confusing for me. Damon ends up making an offer for $500,000 for 25% for a licensing deal. So what did you think about that?
Yeah, so this is an interesting one as well, because in terms of the series of events, and this happens a couple times, they'll give their presentation. Then there's a Q&A period where the sharks will ask these questions. What are your sales? What are your margins? What are your profits? But Damon comes right out of the Q&A and says, this is an offer. Before anyone says they're out, he makes that offer. And sharks do that sometimes. And I feel like almost always, the businesses that say, I want to hear everybody out, might regret it a little bit. Because if everyone else bows out and it comes back to Damon and they bring this up on the show, Damon could very easily undercut his own offer by saying, like, well, look who came crawling back. Now I want a bigger share of it.
Right. And it should be mentioned, when Damon does make a deal, he's always kind of making a deal for that licensing play. That's kind of his shtick. I know Kevin O'Leary, he'll go for the royalties we'll see every now and then. Damon's shtick is he'll go for the licensing deal. So he makes this offer, $500,000, 25% for licensing. We come around to Robert. You know, Robert makes it personal. He's like, my dad's not going to buy this. He's out. We go around to Kevin and, you know, he makes a really good point. This is a very capital intensive product. And he's like, the more successful you are, the more capital gets tied up. And if the market changes, you know, you have a lot of valuable inventory that you're not able to offload. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then we come around to Mark Cuban. And then this is where, you know, they kind of get a little personal, the entrepreneurs, I mean. They go into this pitch about, you know, you invest in the people, not just the product. And he pretty much says verbatim at one point, we know this is not the best product in the world out there. What did you think about that?
I mean, this is sort of them begging on their knees, like we talked about before with Trobo, of like, I think these guys kind of realized as people were slowly dropping out, like, crap, we need anything we can get. And they just try to make that last minute pitch of like, listen, it's risky, but aren't the best things risky? And I think Kevin brings up this good point that, like, as things get more risky, more capital gets tied up. And especially with this whole inventory overseas deal going on, there's a certain point where it's almost like a parabola, where like after a certain point, the more risk you take, the less you're going to get overall.
Right.
So I feel like, you know, you can't just purely throw risk out as a reason to do things. You can't purely depend on how much of a daredevil these sharks are in order to go in on your business.
Right. And speaking of risk, I'm not sure which shark brought it out, but we have Lori and we have Damon. And one of the sharks mentioned, like, do you risk waiting to hear what Lori says, or Lori going out and then you only have Damon left in play, and then Damon can do whatever he wants with the offer? So, you know, that's a little tension point that they make, I believe, going to the commercial break. Lori ends up coming back and says she'll do $500,000 for 30%. Damon, you know, makes this huge reaction, but, you know, he only offered 25%. So I don't know why he's reacting that way.
No, I think, considering that he pulls out immediately afterwards, I think it was just, again, a show for great TV of like, okay, look, you guys are clearly screwed now. Let me pull out as well. And also, there's another contingency that Lori puts. As we said before, Damon's is contingent on licensing. Lori's is contingent on Lowe's giving them that purchase order. As you said before, they sort of like did like a pinky swear with these guys, saying like, yeah, you know, once you get the inventory, we'll give you the order. Lori says, you know, make sure that order is intact, and only then will I give you the money.
Right. And then, you know, we go through the back and forth, and then the offer changes, where Lori then offers $500,000 as a line of credit with 5% interest and 50% equity in the company. What did you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, that was a little bit of a loop, because, I mean, as you said, these guys counter, they try to get the same amount for a lower stake. But then she sort of comes back with not necessarily a stake, but more so a different deal, where essentially now she says, I'm not investing, I'm loaning. Which, I don't know, we talked about accountability before, where, you know, Robert made this deal with Trobo. If the Shrek deal falls through, he doesn't need to give the money. I mean, I wonder, is Lori getting herself in a weird, different type of situation with these guys, where she can say, like, okay, you know, give me my money back once you've made this order?
Right. I mean, so they obviously take the deal because at this point they're really desperate, and they accept the offer of $500,000 as a line of credit 5% interest and 15% equity. And I was thinking, like, do I like this offer? Do I not like this offer? And I was like, A, they definitely needed the cash to begin to fill their orders if the Lowe's deal comes through. And, you know, going back to Lori's history, she's got these links to Home Depot and sort of these hardware stores. So she can definitely help out there. But they have to pay back the money plus interest, which is $25,000. It's nothing to sneeze at. And they have to pay back that money, but still give up 15% of their company. So, yeah. I mean, I'm kind of thumbs down on the deal just because of that.
And at the same time, again, didn't they say that they also have to raise like $1 million outside of this in order to get that overseas inventory work started anyway? So I feel like they're just digging this hole deeper and deeper for themselves. But Lori's just basically handing them a shovel here right. to dig themselves even deeper.
And at the end of the day, I just don't think the product is viable. So thumbs down all around.
So we'll see. Hopefully, I mean, I don't know if we'll see an update on them in the next few episodes. Speaking on update, we're finished with our episode talk, but I kind of want to segue this into a couple of other Shark Tank related questions before I close things off. There is a spinoff, or as ABC puts it, I think like companion series called Beyond the Tank, which essentially takes these little Where Are They Now interstitials from the episode itself and expanding it into more full length episodes where the shark will actually visit the business and talk to them a little bit. Have you seen Beyond the Tank at all?
I actually have not seen Beyond the Tank. It's definitely been on my list of things to watch. I've seen commercials for it and I've seen the products that have gone through it. I think it's a brilliant idea because they know, A, ABC's filling up another time slot. B, they know the more product or the more TV time these products get exposure, naturally, the more profitable they're going to be. So definitely, I think I'm going to start watching it. And if you want to do a podcast on those shows, let me know.
Exactly. It'll be the spinoff to our podcast.
Right.
like an exit interview. We'll put it at the end. One other question I have. Next episode is going to see the return of one of the guest sharks. There are three guest sharks this season, I believe. But probably the most eyebrow-raising one, I would say, is Ashton Kutcher.
Yes.
So do you want to talk a little bit about guest sharks overall and where Ashton kind of falls within that?
So we kind of mentioned that there's a six rotating chairs that happen for the sharks. And then every now and then, a certain shark is not available for a shooting day. So they do bring in guest sharks, to fill up the schedule for sharks not available. But also, you know, they want to see who else could potentially, you know, work with the other sharks and, you know, potentially might be a permanent member of the rotation. So past guest sharks previously were Chris Sacca. He was he's a big Silicon Valley investor. He invested in Airbnb. I think he's in Twitter. Another one was Troy Carter. I think he was Lady Gaga's former manager. And now he's kind of has his own investment deals going on. And a few others, like Jeff Foxworthy, that was eyebrow-raising one. So we have Ashton Kutcher. Everyone kind of knows him as sort of the entertainment guy from Two and a Half Men, That 70s Show, a couple movies. He's generally not known as, you know, a tech investor, but I haven't done too much research on this. And maybe we can talk about this next week if we end up doing a podcast. But he's kind of dabbled here and there in sort of tech investments. Do you know anything more about that?
I don't. And that's honestly the reason why I'm surprised after seeing that he was on this show is just because I can understand that actors totally start out with their own businesses. I mean, you can look at like what Madonna has done with her career as an example and see all the perfume lines tied to celebrities.
I'm actually going to jump in because I just pulled up his Wikipedia. So he has investments in Skype, Foursquare, Airbnb, Path, and Fab.com. So pretty big companies there. And he is a co-founder of the venture capital firm A Grade Investments with a few other people. And at South by Southwest last year, he announced Sound Ventures, or sort of another venture capital fund. So he's actually in there. He's a big player, I guess.
Okay. All right. Well, color me surprised then. I'm excited to see next week what Kelso will bring to the table. I mean, I think he definitely also, I think when you bring in these entertainment people, this is another factor that will make good TV. He definitely seems like he's much more about like joking around and maybe kind of proving he could have more fun than some of these people in suits.
Right.
So, I mean, I'm excited to see him come on, if only for the TV factor, though. I'd be intrigued. You know, Damon, who I believe he's replacing, Damon is very niche. I feel like he has expanded his fashion empire, but I feel like he is very focused most of the time on fashion brands itself. So to have Ashton come in, as you said, his Rolodex is almost diversified with businesses he's invested in. So maybe he has more interest than I thought he once did.
Right. So to recap the night, we had three deals that were made. We had Pride Bite Pet Products. So we got a $200,000 for 20% deal with Lauren Robert. We had Trobo, the storytelling robot, $166,000 deal for 30% with Robert. And Coolbox, a $500,000 line of credit deal with Lori. So big night for Lauren Robert, actually. You know, I started off the podcast saying he's last resort, but Robert got two deals in tonight's episode.
Yeah, this last resort is fully stocked. It is not no vacancies at this last resort.
I'm going to live to regret that comment, I feel like.
it's a good contender for the hashtag.
Yeah, is there anything else you wanted to talk? Our very first Shark Tank wrap up.
I mean, I think it'd be fun if at the very end here, we have six mainline sharks. Do you want to do a quick cumulative power ranking of these six sharks just to see where our taste may lie?
Power ranking. Okay. How do you want to start this?
Well, I guess, I don't know if you want to go, maybe if we want to incorporate both like likability and business sense, et cetera, but for me personally, I would put number one as Lori with a bullet. And again, this might be my personal preferences, but I feel like her general likability paired with her, her sometimes shrewdness paired with the fact that we saw on this episode how successful she is, including helming one of the most successful Shark Tank products of all time, makes her an easy to contender for number one, in my opinion.
Cool. I mean, so she wasn't featured on this episode, but I think my number one, if I were coming in with a company, depending on what the company and the product is, of course, but just as sort of a theoretical idea, I think my number one would be Barbara Corcoran. I feel like Lori definitely has had some blockbuster products, but I feel like Barbara definitely has a good success with her entrepreneurs. And definitely I have to back that up with some research, but my feeling is her entrepreneurs have been very successful. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that she is very emotionally invested in her entrepreneur. She's one of the sharks that's like, I'm going to invest in the person, not necessarily the product and the company. And I feel like that level of attention, like, you know, Mark's a billionaire. He has a lot of connections. I just don't think if I were to make an investment with Mark, I'm going to get that level of attention that I'm going to get from Barbara. And I think that's definitely what I'm looking for, that strategic partner when I'm making a deal with someone.
No, that totally makes sense. And I'm thinking back to like episode one, which I think I rewatched the other day, had that like Ava the elephant, the ear and eye drops for kids. And Barbara was the only one to take a bite at that. And as a result, it's no scrub daddy level, but it's definitely one of the more successful products and one of the big success stories that came out from that show right out of the gate. So I would put Barbara up there as well. Maybe we could even just do tiers. If we put like Lori and Barbara up there, are there any people that you feel like are in that top tier of Shark Tank investors?
Yeah, I mean, this is going to sound really hilarious, but I would definitely put Kevin up there, even though, you know, he's mean. But I feel like when he does invest, I feel like because he's such a tough investor, I would feel like if he's willing to invest in me, he obviously must see something. And like he has been very successful. So like I would put him in like the second tier of like, you know, maybe I would do business with him, but like I don't necessarily like the deals that he always offers. But, you know, every now and then he has like an amazing success story. Like, have you heard of his wicked cupcakes that he always brings up every now and then?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I would definitely agree. I think as much of a character as we play him up as much of a ridiculous person as he may build himself up to be, I think he is a good businessman. And even in this episode, he's imparting great advice about how risk compares to capital being tied up. So I put him up there as well. Maybe below him, I'm trying to decide between like Mark and Robert, because I think that
I would put Mark there.
Yeah, I would probably put Mark there as well. Maybe my mind is clouded by your Mr. Last Resort comment, but I feel like Mark is sort of in the same boat in that, like, yes, he's very bombastic, but he does have pretty good business sensibilities. And so, yes, he may sound like a douche most of the time, but he has good words behind that douchiness.
Right. And I think, what is going with Mark in terms of like, if you had him as an investor, he has the biggest name recognition of any of the sharks by far. So, you know, once you leave the Shark Tank world and you're just out there like pitching to other investors or trying to sell your product, to say, hey, I've got Mark Cuban as a strategic investor, that will take your product really far. So I would put Mark in that category just for the name recognition.
And I'm going to put Robert above Damon. I know you call him Mr. Last Resort, but I feel like Robert does... I mean, the fact is, I know some decisions may be questionable, like Trobo the robot, but Robert does also, I feel like, make more deals and buy into more products, whereas Damon is the guy that will almost usually be like the first person out. And when he does make a deal, he makes a very big, grandiose deal. So I personal preference would put Robert above.
You know, I'm so going to walk back this last resort shark thing. I like Robert. I mean, you know, he's obviously Canadian like me, and he is, you know, he's so friendly, or at least he comes across as very friendly on the show. And I think he does invest in things he genuinely cares about, like Barbara does. So, you know, I would agree to putting Robert above Damon.
All right. So that's our loose power rankings. If we keep doing this, who knows? They may change depending on how the season progresses. But that does bring up a good point. So this is our pitch podcast. This is our test product, if you will, our prototype that we have distributed to you. It's been tailored for you personally, listener. But we want to know from you guys if you would like us to keep going. And we're always accepting to constructive criticism as well as to, you know, as segments you think we should do, questions you want us to answer, et cetera, et cetera. So if you want to let us know what you think about this podcast and whether you want to see more, obviously you can respond in the comments to this post on robhasawebsite.com. But you can also reach out to us via social media. I am at a Mike Bloom type on Twitter. Jasmine, any social media info you'd like to give out?
Yeah, you can definitely reach me on Twitter. I am at Jasmeet Sidhu. So that's just my full name, Jasmeet Sidhu. And yeah, I mean, I had a really good time talking about this. I obviously love the show very much. And I would love to continue recapping it if you guys want us to keep doing it.
Absolutely. So yeah, definitely let us know if you're in or you're out. And now, would it be okay with you if we made the hashtag Mr. Last Resort, or would you feel like that's too defaming?
I think we can do it. You want to do Mr. Last Resort or Last Resort Shark?
We can do Last Resort Shark. I like that. So it kind of ties into the podcast. So yeah, Last Resort Shark, if you made it all the way to the end here. Again, please let us know if you want to see more of this. We would love to come back. Jasmeet, welcome to RHAP. Thank you so much for coming on. I had a really great time.
Yeah, me too. Thank you for having me.
Of course. And so hopefully we will see you back again next time. But for now, the tank is closed.